AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm David Canfield, and I'm here for today's interview episode with Hilary Busis. Hi, Hilary.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
We have two interviews this week with people who I would say you may not know their names, but you very much should. A little later in the show, I spoke with Anna Sawai, the breakout star of Shogun. But to start, we're going to feature your interview with Alex Edelman, who has his special Just for Us on HBO and Max. Now, I was watching this the other night alone, and my husband was working in the other room, and he heard me laughing hysterically, and he was like, "What are you laughing at?" Because I don't laugh alone very much, and it was at this show. So, Hilary, how did you find Alex? What did you guys talk about?
Yeah, our conversation was delightful. I will say that it is probably going to be more fun to listen to it after you have seen the special or after you have seen the stage show, which the special is adapted from, also called Just For Us. So Alex Edelman has been working with this same material for the past 6 years, honing it. And the special is kind of the final version before he stops performing it live and moves on to new stuff. But yeah, he's just a really funny comedian who wrote this really sharp, really interesting, really surprising show that's about Jewish identities particularly, but also kind of whiteness and like questions about what that means. It kind of all centers on this story he tells about how he came upon a tweet from a white supremacist inviting people who live in New York to come to a meeting of white supremacists that night. And Alex Edelman, who is Jewish, was like, "Oh, maybe I'll go and see what happens." And so that's the premise. But from there, it kind of spins out in a lot of very interesting directions. I mean, that's kind of enough as a premise.
It's enough.
Yes. I don't know if you really need to go much more than that. But yeah, I saw him do this live in the summer of 2022. And seeing it live in a room with other people is a really special experience, but I think that the special captures that same mood in a really good way. It's directed by Alex Timbers, who's a great stage director and also a great stand-up special director. He's done a lot of John Mulaney stuff. So yeah, I'm excited to share this conversation. It was really fun to talk to him.
All right, well, let's get into it with Alex Edelman.
I saw so many child psychiatrists growing up in the greater Boston area. The last one was free. And I just have like one memory. I'm sitting on this brown couch in this doctor's office, and my mom is outside in the waiting room talking to the doctor. And I just remember hearing her go, "What do you mean he's fine?"
Alex, thank you so much for coming on Little Gold Men to talk with us about Just For Us.
Not at all. I'm so excited to be here.
Okay, so I was curious, in your announcement, you posted on Instagram that you were coming up to the last run of live shows for Just For Us. You said, "There will be no more live Just For Us's unless I'm being offered a truly eye-popping amount of sweet, sweet cash in a pristine duffel bag or metal suitcase." I'm curious, can you just not do this show anymore? Is it too exhausting? There seems to be a note of exhaustion in that.
I mean, how real are we going to get here?
It's up to you. I'd love you to get as real as you feel like getting.
Look, I love my show. It's like the best truest expression of myself, like, which sounds really crazy, but I do think I'm the type of person that takes an hour to 2 hours to explain to people. So this is the only form which I can be like, no, this is why I am the way I am. But it is, it has been really special. But no, I've been doing the show for 6 years with some real serious breaks in between. But it's also time for people to see it in on the screen. It's what's best for the work. We had a really great opportunity to make this in a really great way, which is on Broadway. And so that's for the piece. For myself personally, I made this show as a stage show with my best friend, a guy named Adam Brace. We worked together for 11 years. Then Adam passed away.
The special is dedicated to him.
Yes. Almost exactly 11 months ago. Oh. And the last, the week that he, the day that, not to, hey, gosh, the day that I, pardon me, the day that I do the show last will be exactly 11 months since he passed. And so that's how long you say Kaddish for. Like, it's, so personally, I love doing the show. And the reason I'm like, how real are we going to get here? Is because I don't want to be like mawkish, 3 minutes into a podcast. But some days the show is like the most wonderful escape. And some days it feels like I'm saying Kaddish and really like I'm in conversation in some ways with a person who can't talk back to me. And that can be hard. That can be really hard. And I never had a problem doing the show over and over again. I always found things to change. The show is really a special experience for me. Like, it's a really, it spurs lots of conversation. It's full of jokes. So people seem to enjoy it and laugh all the way through. And I've never had a complaint in 6 years from an audience member on the entertainment front. Some people disagreed with things, but people seem very generally entertained by the show. That's something that's worth doing, even if you start doing other things. But yeah, I miss my friend. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to – we would talk about the show every single day. And so how it went the night before and, X, Y, Z. And sometimes he was busy with his other jobs. So, maybe we wouldn't speak till like late evening. But he got a show report every single night from our great stage managers. And so and he had real affection for those stage managers. And so like it's nice. And now – the stage managers still write the show report, but it's like, who it goes to. So yeah, sorry. That's a long answer now too, but that's why. But yeah, if someone gives me like $500,000 for a show or something, I'm not going to be like, oh no, I'm sad. I'll do the thing. I'm a capitalist. I'm an effervescent capitalist. I'll really like, but also the show is really a beautiful thing. It's time to move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine, doing the same material over and over and, it changes, as you said, but that must be, and it's personal in a lot of ways, it's about you and your family. So how did you approach kind of putting it in its final form for this special? Like, what did you want to make sure happened for the filmed version?
I believe that if possible, things should also be other things. Like, I love that my comedy show is theater, and I love that theater is my comedy show, and that my peanut butter is chocolate, and my chocolate is peanut butter, and, all this type of stuff. And so the show has lots of comedy, and it's also got a narrative. It's also got, a lot of suspense. But I wanted someone who had a really strong sense of narrative and had also done stand-up. And there are only a few people on the planet who can do that. And Alex Timbers is kind of the best at it. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, I don't know anyone else who's done Broadway and stand-up. Like, if there is someone, my apologies, seriously, but Alex really understands theater because he directs, Moulin Rouge and Beetlejuice and Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. And also, he does Mulaney stuff. And so AT, really, we had conversation after conversation about how to preserve, how to make the special dynamic and weird without any sort of forced, crazy insane shots where the camera's like this or like right in my eyes or something like that. So Alex really took a narrative eye to it. And we really, and not to get too technical, but instead of shooting, like we did a little specialty shoot, we got a small audience in there and the camera was on stage with me. And then Alex said to me, he's like, just so you know, we're going to use those sporadically, but effectively. And we really did. Like he really understood how to thread that needle between making a thing that was like artistic enough to be artistic, but also like accessible enough to still be undoubtedly a stand-up special. So like, you know, we're very careful of like wanting to be all things at once. You know, compromise, really good for artists usually, but...
artists famously love, yeah, having to having to compromise their vision.
This seems really silly, but like, I love compromise. Like, mm-hmm. I really do. I love trying to find the biting point between something that is in conversation with a moment, but also an escape from it, or something that is very personal, but also accessible to lots of people. Something that does... to a really trained ear, have the thoroughness of something that's well-worn, but also to someone seeing comedy for the first time or seeing comedy, you know, casually, has a thing that they can enjoy too. Like, I do not believe that entertainment is like a dirty word. And so like, I really like trying to find a thing that works for me and also works for lots of other people. I'm sure at some point I'll find pieces that are largely in it, you know, I'll make things that are inaccessible to a wide swath of people, but like, mm-hmm. I really like the compromise parts of this show. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think that's a good segue into the actual material of the show, because your ability to kind of see all sides is kind of what gets you into the predicament that you're in this story that you tell, which is, you know, for those who aren't familiar with it or maybe haven't watched it yet. In 2017, it was?
Very beginning of 2018, maybe.
Okay. So the very beginning of 2018, we're still like early in the Trump years. You saw on Twitter that there was a meeting of white nationalists in Queens, and you decide to go and obviously not tell anybody that you're Jewish, but just go and kind of see what happens.
Because running through this meeting is this thick vein of anti-Semitism, but I've never seen this kind of anti-Semitism before. It's almost exhilarating. It's like thick, technicolor, weapons-grade, conspiracy theory level anti. Like at some point, this guy two seats away from me, he just went, "Jews are sneaky and they're everywhere." And I was like, seems like the wrong time to argue with this guy, actually.
I think what's really interesting about the show, something that you said in an interview with Jason Zinnemann of the New York Times, is that you're trying to have a conversation about Jews and their place on the spectrum of whiteness without having a conversation about victimhood, which I think is really interesting and kind of an approach that, you know, there is, I'm Jewish, so I can say this, but it seems like a lot of Jewish comedy and maybe even Jewish art more like broadly is focused kind of on Jewish identity as it relates to like persecution and trauma and everything. And I don't know, like there is certainly some of that in this, but it's also kind of a more complicated question about like Jews and race and, you know, whiteness specifically.
I mean, I just don't, I won't say who, a really lovely person said something in an article about the show where they were called out by somebody else. And that person, the person who had been called out, sent me an email going, you know, just so you know, this, and this is the type of careful dialogues that people apparently have in theater. Just so you know, so-and-so sent me an email calling me out and saying I should apologize. And so I'm going to send you an email letting you know that if you felt hurt by this, I'm happy to apologize to you and apologize publicly. And I was like, you know, and so like, I wanted to write them a thoughtful email back. And I said, I think a really good lesson of the show, if you have to take a lesson from a comedy show, is that we ought not to pretend to feel like victims when we don't. And so mm-hmm. like, I don't feel like a victim, but I'm also aware that there has been a cost to the assimilation process for me. And so I think that's a much more interesting conversation than I am a persecuted person. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I mean, look, victimhood can be interesting, just like college admissions, like, right? Like, people are – college admissions is fascinating because it's the one thing in our culture where every single group feels like they're the ones being discriminated against. White people, people of all different, you know, types of backgrounds of color, Jews, non-Jews, rich people think they're victims, poor people think they're victims. Everyone thinks they're a victim. And so that can be really interesting. But for the most part, I find the conversation about victimhood to be very dehumanizing and very not good for comedy and very boring. And like you said, Hillary, like, just not something I want to see anymore in, like, Jewish art, unless it's like, I think it flattens people from characters into archetypes. I think mm-hmm. it's like, it's really like kind of dumb and useless. And so I find the conversation about, like, about Jewish identity to be much more, like, varied and complex than, are we, how persecuted are we? Like, mm-hmm. it's a real, really interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, the other side of that coin also is, like, I'm persecuted, so nobody can ever get mad at me, which, like, just, like, shuts down any nuance or any progress.
And also, by the way, is, like, dehumanizing to people who claim it. Like, it's very, like, you know, a good question, I think, for people is, what is more inappropriate, to offer people ultimate grace or to offer them a little grace or to offer them no accountability or to offer them more accountability? Like, what is the actual right thing to do? Because, like, you know, everyone likes to commend me for, like, well, you humanize these white nationalists. And I'm like, well, they're human beings. Mm-hmm. But I also never give them a pass. I never don't say that Nazis are bad or being a Nazi is. But I'm also very aware. You know Pauline Kael, obviously,
yes.
Given the position that you occupy in the culture.
Mm-hmm. some call me this generation's Pauline Kael, but yes.
Really? I'd like to meet those people because it feels like I'm now going to be tweeting that you say that you're this. In it. I mean, I like to think of myself as this generation's Pauline Kael, but
then we're going to have a problem.
I know. There could all be one.
Anyway,
Pauline Kael, if you're listening and you don't know who Pauline Kael was, she was the legendary cactus-like critic for The New Yorker for film. And everyone else was giving Judgment at Nuremberg, which is a movie that came out, one of the first sort of great Holocaust films or post-Holocaust films, about the Nuremberg trials. Everyone was giving it great reviews, and Pauline Kael was scathing. And she said, someone asked her about it, and she said it took a very brave stance against being a Nazi. And so I thought that was really apropos. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I really hate that. I really hate people taking a brave stance against being a Nazi. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's not good to be one. So I think threading that needle can be more interesting, more clever, more tactile.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the big takeaways from the show is how pathetic the white supremacists that you met are. Like, they're just these losers in a room complaining.
Yes. Well, most of us are just losers in a room complaining. But yes, they are. I point out the inefficacy.
Yeah. Well, and that also kind of feels like it is, you know, in line with kind of a great Jewish history of making fun of Nazis, you know, making them ridiculous, you know, the Mel Brooks School of Comedy. I don't know if that's something that you were kind of specifically trying to do.
Oh, God, I love him. I'd say him and Norman Lear have been something of, like, benign grandfather figures in the sense that I get lots of notes from Mel and his person, Kevin Salter. They've been very supportive of me for almost a decade and, like, really wonderful because he's my prime influence. I'd say Mel's up there. Mel, and on the non-Jewish side, Steve Martin, you know, like, they've been so huge for me. So I worship him appropriately the way you would, the way mm-hmm. anyone should worship Mel Brooks.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hillary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
I guess we've already been kind of deep, so I guess this isn't necessarily taking us in a new direction.
Say whatever you want to say.
Well, no, I'm curious about the experience of performing the show after October 7th and kind of how that affected you and affected your performance. And I don't know if there's any material that you felt like you've had to change or edit out or add.
I think that I thought really deeply after October 7th about what to change in the show, whether to perform the show differently. And, you know, I thought that it should sort of be addressed at the top. So there's now an address at the top, which isn't in the special. And I'm glad isn't in the special. I think a show, like I said, I like a show that's conversant with a moment, but also an escape from it. Mm-hmm. The show's also not about that, even though Judaism is a, you know, theme of the show. I think that requires like really careful consideration. So there's some contextual things. There are things in the show that seem spicier or hit harder because of October 7th. And I've noted different reactions to the jokes, but I say at the top of the show when I do it live, I'm doing it live this week for the last time, unless again, someone offers me a Samsonite case full of sweet, sweet cash. What I say is when I was in high school, I saw John Updike give a talk. And John Updike said, if you're lucky, at some point in your life, the work that you write will find itself in conversation with the times in which you live. And then I go, well, call me Mr. Lucky. So, yeah, but I like that because, you know, it lets people know that I'm aware of what's going on, but I'm not like a slave to what's going on. The show should be conversant with a moment, but it shouldn't be entirely beholden to it. I think that's bad for the art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, there, you know, obviously art and politics have no choice but to intersect and get in each other's way and everything. I'm curious if you were following the controversy around Jonathan Glazer's speech at the Oscars and if you had any thoughts about that.
I thought it was a fascinating inflection point for people to look, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is supposed to be the focus of my next show.
Is your next show going to be 20 hours long?
Yeah, it's going to be 20 hours long with footnotes from Edward Said, Leon Uris, Abba Eben, and, you know, all the others. I think the conflict is like, everyone, sometimes people are like, it's not complicated. This is true, or this is true, or this is true. People feel very differently about even the facts on the ground based on where they're from, or based on what they were raised with, or based on their personal experience, or based on, you know, the news and stuff like that. The truth of the matter is, it feels like it's really hard to move anyone off of their position in the dialectic. And like, that to me as an observer is really fascinating. And for something like that speech, watching everyone, you know, emerge from their corners of the dialectic briefly to like raise their hands and say their things, it's like, it's really, really is something. As someone who's fascinated with discourse and how we speak to each other, because I'm still an optimist that discourse can produce like productive, you know, productive results. It makes me sad. Like I don't see anyone moving off their line. I don't see anyone changing their things. All of my extremely anti-Zionist friends are the same as they was before. All of my Zionist friends are the same as they was before. All of my friends who don't like to think or talk about it, pretty much all of them don't like to think or talk about it. But you know how I personally felt about the speech when I watched and weigh in, my thought now is the way we talk about it rarely makes me reflect on the actual situation on the ground. It makes me reflect on the way we talk about it. So, and I'm not saying that that's right, because I don't think it is. I think that's wrong, but I think it's a reality. And I think that's something, I don't know. I'm not saying anything particularly original or even interesting here. But it would be nice if that changed. I don't know. It's just like I spent all day thinking about this thing, so I'm trying to squeeze literally hours and hours and hours of complicated thought into a chestnut. So,
mm-hmm. Totally makes sense. Something that you say in the special near the end is that you're obscenely easy to reach on social media. Has that become less true as the special or as the show, as you've performed it and, you know, more people have seen it?
Yeah, I'm still easy to reach on social media, but I have a much more astringent content filter now. Like there's somehow the algorithm in blessedly tried to. I'm like also barely on Twitter. Twitter kind of is not as that's not true. I just don't really engage as much with Twitter anymore, I guess. But Instagram is really where I see things and people write me messages and I have good conversations or bad conversations. And so like, but at some point the high quality stuff makes it through and the low quality stuff kind of gets filtered out. But I've had really good conversations with people that I have different opinions from on Instagram. And maybe that is the point of a social media that's functioning.
Yeah. And I noticed that on Twitter, your Jewish National Fund donors list, which is actually a list of anti-Semites, is still active.
Oh my God. You know what? People so rarely go and check. I'm so like, please. I mean, isn't it vile?
It's not a good read. No.
Oh, it's just grotesque. But you know what's so interesting is that when I started that list, it was so different from the average feed. And now sometimes I'm like, am I on my list or am I on the feed? Because I'm seeing open anti-Semitism and racism and sexism, but is it from the regular stuff the algorithm's
feeding? Elon Musk?
I mean, it truly is. Like, Hillary is so crazy to have. Sometimes I'm like, did I make this happen? Sometimes I'm like, is that list the thing that made this go? Like, it's just terrifying. It's truly, it's like, oh, it's a battery. It's really awful.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that list somehow infected the rest of the platform.
I'm just like, maybe if I had started a list about tulips, then tulips would be most people's feeds now. Maybe some rogue worm got a hold of my list and was like, oh, the worst stuff possible, an open sewer. That's what we want.
Oh, well, I feel like that opens up an avenue to make a joke about being from Boston, but I don't want to.
Are you from Boston?
Offend anybody? No, but I know you are.
Yes, I am.
But I grew up in a place where there were different kinds of white people. I grew up in a place where there was a strict hierarchy for whiteness. I grew up in Boston. I grew up in this really racist part of Boston called Boston. And in Boston.
By the way, Boston embodies that contradiction. Boston is probably the most progressive place in the United States and also extremely regressive in some corners. It's extremely moneyed and working class. It's extremely Jewish and not Jewish. It's extremely urban and also just a few miles outside of it, ex-urban and then downright agrarian. Like it is a really special, strange, wonderful, awful, intellectual, dumb place. Like there are just so many great and crazy things about Boston. It's such a great place to grow up. So if I had my druthers, and I very rarely get to have my druthers, but if I had my druthers, I would druther to raise my kids in Boston. It's this really, there's stuff happening. I have a lot of love for like New York and LA, but I also really love like not New York and LA, like getting to other places on this tour. When I was in Atlanta, I was like, great place. This seems like a really cool place to grow up. Like, people need to grow up with strangeness and weirdness and danger, like, you know, not life-threatening danger, but like you should be able to see all things. And so like, I don't know, I've seen a lot of strangeness the last couple of years on the road. So it's been really cool. Mm-hmm.
So we're speaking now, by the time this airs, you will have performed your last performance. The special will be out there. Kind of What are you gonna do with yourself? What's like your immediate like post Just For Us plan?
Well, I'm writing and directing a Christmas movie, based on a story from the special, so that'll be really something. I'm writing a book about places I don't belong. So I spent some time in places I don't belong. I did a pottery apprenticeship in Japan. I've gone to a bunch of like NASCAR races. I've I've went to go see Louis Farrakhan speak a couple weeks ago, which was crazy. Like really, really crazy. Mm-hmm. And I'll do a little more acting and a little more writing for television and like start doing the next thing. And also I have a new show at Netflix's Joke Festival May 11th, and it's going to have to be an hour of material that's not just for us. So better hop to it, Edelman, you know, better, better get out there and do all your stuff. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to start the iterative process of like going back to being a stand-up comedian and an actor and a writer. It's like really cool.
Yeah. Okay. So not too much. You're going to give yourself some time to breathe.
No, I'm not going to give myself any time to breathe, but it's going to be different things. Like I don't believe in vacations or breaks. And also maybe I'll start writing maybe I'll stop avoiding I say avoiding the news. I'm glued to it about Israel and Gaza, but maybe I'll start trying to see if I can get I'll look for a way in a little bit. It's time to like try to get my arms around some big stuff again. So
mm-hmm. I'm very much looking forward to whatever you have to say about it once you figure it out.
You and nobody else.
Next, we're going to go to my conversation with Anna Sawai, an actress I admittedly knew absolutely nothing about. I had seen Pachinko. I didn't remember she was in that. So I really went in fresh here, and she has just blown me away in Shogun. Hillary, I think you've started watching the show as well.
I have, yes. And I agree that she is definitely one of the major selling points of it. All three of the main actors, I think, are really giving great performances. But yeah, as Lady Mariko, she's got a lot to do. She's got motivations that are maybe kind of murky and shifting. And yeah, just kind of watching how she's navigating feudal Japan is very gripping and very hard to look away from.
Yeah, she's really caught between two worlds in this show. She plays essentially the interpreter for this English sailor, John Blackthorne, played by Cosmo Jarvis, who lands.
Who, when he speaks English on the show, is actually speaking Portuguese, which took me a minute to understand.
It is a unique form of English, I will say. I've heard many impressions of it, and they're all quite good. So he lands in feudal Japan, and he's taken in the middle of this real power struggle in Japan by Lord Torinaga, who's played by Hiroyuki Sanada, who sort of takes him in as an asset. And Mariko is Blackthorne's translator. And out of that, we get to know these three characters in really different ways. And she has this poise and also this kind of dry wit. This is the one thing I like to say about Shogun. It is a lot funnier than people think it is, or at least it makes me laugh. And she's one big reason why, because she has this intelligence that gives you this bird's eye view of the whole thing. So we're talking about episode 8, so some mild spoilers for anyone who is not to that point. Her character reaches a real turning point as the major conflicts in this series are about to come to a head, and she makes a claim for being a part of that conflict in a way that I find really interesting for the character and also really juicy for the actor. So let's get into it. Well, Anna, thanks for joining us. You are... I would like to say that the discovery of this TV season so far, people between Shogun and Monarch, I've heard a lot of people talking about you. I'm sure you've experienced that a little bit as well.
Thank you so much for the lovely introduction. I'm just glad that people are watching these shows.
As am I, because they're both excellent and very deserved. We are here to talk about Shogun, which is a pretty extraordinary show. And episode 8 has just aired, and we're going to get into that. I wanted to start just by talking a little bit generally about your experience with this show. You shot it a while ago. I'm actually just curious to start, like, when you were first cast in this show.
Yeah, I think it was back in 2021. On my birthday, I got a call saying that they wanted me to play Mariko. And by then, I had really wanted to do it, but I also felt a lot of pressure because it was going to be my first jidaigeki, which is the Japanese, period piece. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I was going to have to take a lot of lessons. I would have to learn how to speak. And it was a lot. And so I remember going into these classes and then putting me in a kimono and kind of being introduced to the character in a physical way at first, which was amazing because whenever I would wear it, I felt like I was now entering 1600.
It's such a physical performance, necessarily, right? Just given what you're wearing, what the customs are, how different characters are meant to interact based on, you know, authority and gender and things like that. Was there a point where it felt like, not natural to you, but you could kind of slip into that mode and really embody that kind of physical presence that you that it requires?
We had a lot of training in Japan before going to Vancouver, and then training again in Vancouver and as we shot. And so after the first day, I think I was already like very much, whenever I wear the kimono and I have my wig on and I'm walking onto set and I'm smelling the tatami floors or just being surrounded by all the samurai and everyone kind of acting in a different way, the people on set also kind of knew they had to bring that energy. And so I was already slipping in then. I didn't have to really rely on many months of the shoot to go on in order to feel that comfort.
Mm. So in terms of the, I suppose, like emotional experience of playing this role, I believe you said like you didn't anticipate how much it would affect you playing this part, being a part of this project. Can you talk a little bit about just the personal quality of what this has meant to you, both in the playing of it and I would imagine in just in the talking about it and experiencing it?
It's interesting to talk about it now and revisiting the character in these interviews, because I think when I was playing her, I was so focused on what I had to do that day and what scene we were shooting that I wasn't really understanding what I was mentally going through. I was just thinking of, I was just in the mindset of Mariko. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I'm looking at it from a third person's point of view, and I can see that how deeply it has affected me. And it's just interesting because I guess all these small elements, things like, you know, Hosokawa Garashi-san, who is the inspiration of Mariko, actually existed. Mm-hmm. That already really made me feel like, oh, I have to understand that this is real. This isn't just a made-up mm-hmm. story. And then being involved with people like Justin and Rachel and Hiro-san and Eriko and everyone, really, truly, all the crew that was there, like they were putting their all into it. And I have been on many sets, but I feel like it was really extreme mm-hmm. to the point that I couldn't enjoy it as much, but it was that much more meaningful. So I think the whole experience just shaped it into this magnificent project, but at the time it was very, very tough.
Mm. So in the talking of it, as you're saying, what about it has felt interesting or maybe surprising just in having to revisit it in that way?
It's interesting because for the first month, whenever I talked about Mariko's dad or certain scenes, the later scenes, I would start tearing up. There are certain scenes that they would show me, and watching it, I would just remember how I felt playing that scene, and I would just cry. And so like seeing myself react in that way was like, oh, I still deeply care about this character. And she means something to me, and she's kind of still in me. So mm-hmm. to see that effect is like, wow. This is very, very heavy and something so impactful. And I hope that people watching her story will also feel a similar way.
Hmm, I think they do. In terms of some of the choices that you make with this character, I'm fascinated by the balance of having to, you know, meet that level of precision that you were talking about in terms of this being based on somebody real, based in this very real time period. With playing a character with a really vibrant, complicated personality and different kinds of relationships, I was even thinking about like your tone, you know, when you're translating, and there's a kind of dryness to it. I was wondering if you could talk about that side of it, like bringing out her personality and showing her as someone who's really singular, even for this time period.
I think it was something that I had to kind of experiment with because mm-hmm. I felt as an actor that I need to express everything. But then in reality, women weren't allowed to do that. You know, she's just a translator. So whatever she's thinking is not relevant in the scene. What she has to do is just translate the words. And I love that you can see with the vocabulary that she's choosing, the wording, that we get a sense of, oh, like she didn't want to translate that bit, or she's trying to protect Blackthorn mm-hmm. right now. And it's very interesting because the only person that really understands what's going on is Mariko. Blackthorn has his point of view and whatever I'm saying, but he doesn't know 100% what Toranaga-sama is saying at times and mm-hmm. vice versa. And so it was really fun to kind of just play with the words. Not, I wasn't really changing the words or anything, but to have the few seconds where you can see her kind of thinking and saying it in a different way was fun. But yeah, performance-wise, I think it was, I did struggle because I felt in some scenes, I felt stuck and I would go to Hiro-san and ask him what I needed to do in order to feel like I'm doing it right. And he was like, it's fine that you're feeling that because Mariko is not allowed to show what she's feeling. So just embody that, you know, that's going to make the performance even more realistic.
And given the circumstances, just the narrative of this story, we do see her emotionally open up a little bit over time. How did you chart that particular arc? And even thinking about episode 8 specifically, you know, you have this scene with your husband in the show, and it's raw because it feels like the first time that she's really communicated to him what he's always denied her in a way.
I love that you bring up her husband because I think it's really interesting to see that in the first three episodes, she's so shut down. And then once her husband dies, you see that she's a different person in episode 4. And then in the fifth episode, he comes back and then the walls are up again and she's very cold and stern. And then that tea house scene is the first time that she's able to verbally open up to him. But even in that scene, I think there's a lot that she's holding in. If this were John Blackthorne, she would have probably been able to express it in a different way. But just the relationship that they had was written as she was never happy with him. And so for him to give her a hand and be like, let's do this together, is almost her feeling like, wow, you really don't understand. And it felt so, I felt so frustrated in that scene because it was like, you don't get it. And in a way it was like, I feel sorry for you. And I love that they chose the shot that they did because, you know, she's not saying a lot, but the words that she does choose to say and the expression that you see is, I think, very telling.
There's almost like a profound disappointment there, too, in the way you play it of like, he's just not going to get it.
Yeah. But like after she says it, you see his reaction to that. And it's just like, it's like a mic drop.
Yeah. Yes, that's a great way of putting it.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
I mean, I think it's the power of the show, though, where, so we to back up a little bit, we are led to believe that he is dead earlier in the season. It's revealed he survived, unbeknownst to the other characters. And that moment where you see him again is, for the audience, it is a little bit devastating because we just spent all this time with Mariko and Blackthorn, and they have this kind of idyllic, romantic almost evening together, and it's very exciting to watch. And so you feel as an audience member almost that being taken away. It's interesting the way that journey is mirrored between me as a viewer and the character.
Mm-hmm. I wish we got to see a little bit more of the happy times of them together.
Me too.
Yeah. But I mean, we are covering the whole book in 10 episodes, and there's, you know, only so much that we can cover. So I think episode 4 is very special in that way.
Yes, definitely. It's kind of a big question, but I wonder, as you really got deep into playing her, you know, this was a 10-month shoot, and really big themes come up in terms of where she is in the world, particularly around life and death. And that's this kind of the theme of that conversation with her husband, is he thinks she's thinking about death when she's actually thinking about life. How did you think about her relationship to those concepts?
I think, well, it's not like I agree with it, but just understanding that people back then had that kind of value. And then just wrapping my head around the fact that, yeah, meaningful life doesn't mean living longer. You can, in the case of the gardener, you can, and many other characters, death can like lead to a greater cause. Hmm. Like you may be able to do something more impactful because of your death. And so I think when I saw these characters and how they really changed the choices of the people that were left, I was able to understand that that is a thing, and Mariko's values are that. Hmm.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that in the context of playing a character like this, because I would argue, and I know you've said as well, in most past iterations of Japanese history in this time period, female characters were not given the kind of complexity that Mariko and others in the show are given. And there is a real respect, I think, for the way she views death and life, while also bringing out subtly these other sides of her. How did you find just that duality and being able to approach the wholeness of that experience in a way that past versions maybe would not have?
I think it was really complicated for Mariko, just because she is a Christian, but she's also a samurai, and they have very different beliefs. She does convert to Christianity, to Catholicism, mm-hmm. 14 or 15 years ago, when we meet her, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it could have been anything. I don't believe that she became a Catholic thinking about the politics and the money and the power that, you know, they had. It was more about giving meaning to life when she didn't want it. And so there was a question of, okay, so which one is she? Like, which one is she going to take in the end? And it was always that you don't have to be either or. You could be both. So trying to understand that was a little bit of a process to me. And I talked to Rachel Kondo a lot, who works with Justin, and she's also mm-hmm. the executive producer. And she gave me she shared with me this beautiful story about her grandmother. And it all made sense once I knew what that was for her and why she believed that it was possible to have these like very conflicting beliefs. So yeah, once I understood that and being able to see the struggles of her, the suffocation and the brokenness, all of that, while having this very, very strong core. And I think, you know, the suffocation, all of that is so relevant to Japanese women today, which is very sad, because I would like to think that people don't understand it because it's so foreign and it's so long ago, but it's still very much there. And you know, thinking about the people that I know, that I grew up with and who I've talked to, and reflecting on my life and what I've been told about men and how I've had to act in Japan when I was working there, all of that kind of made it easy to channel this like very fragile yet powerful figure.
I'd love to talk about kind of the turning point, big moment for Mariko in episode 8, which is when she's going to Osaka. We see she's joining Tornaga and his and all of those folks. There's a resolve, I think, in the way you play that scene, and when she says, "I'm ready." What did you make of her in that moment, and what did you really want to put across as she embarks on what we can glean just from that the weight of that moment will be a, you know, very transformational journey?
I think that scene is just so key. In that scene, she gains clarity. Mm-hmm. Up until then, we see her almost giving up and asking permission to take her own life because she doesn't feel that she's living up to the person that she should be. But after seeing what happens to Hiromatsu Dono and how he sacrifices his life to serve his lord, gives her so much clarity, and she knows exactly what she needs to do, and that is what she wants to do. And by choosing that, she gets to serve her lord, she gets to answer to her father's wishes, and she gets to free herself. Mm-hmm. So I think we see this huge transformation from that moment forward.
What do you make of these scenes in the show that are so powerful and completely silent, where it is two characters looking at each other and there's so much being said with no dialogue at all? And particularly, I think Toranaga and Mariko have that a lot. And in this scene, it's almost kind of like a culmination of their relationship and the way we viewed it. How did you view playing those scenes and that one particularly?
I really love the moments where there wasn't dialogue, because I think it's part of the Japanese culture. We don't speak a lot. We don't really state our opinion as much. And I found that frustrating in the past. But then doing the tea ceremony scene and learning that Japanese people would just look at the cup and admire it rather than being like, look at this design, it's beautiful. Right. You know, that's where we come from. And so the looks and just the quietness, but sensing the other person, kind of reading the other person, mm-hmm. is so important to our culture. And also, I love that Mariko is not really allowed to look at her lord's eyes, mm-hmm. Directly. It's a sign of respect to kind of just have your gaze a little down to the throat. But mm-hmm. when she does tell him that she's ready, she does look up at him, and it's so strong because you don't mm-hmm. see her looking directly in his eyes most of the time. Hmm.
You mentioned you shot this chronologically. Did you have like all the scripts beforehand? Like what sense did you have of the arc and how it would develop? Obviously knowing that there is a book and a prior miniseries, but this is its own thing as well.
I can't remember when we got all 10 episodes, but I had read the book, and we already knew where Mariko's journey was going. So nothing was especially surprising. I think it was more, okay, what lines, how much of mm-hmm. of the novel are we taking into this episode, and what exactly is she saying? But it's always nice to just know the path, because when you don't, and I have worked on things where we're shooting it and we only know until like the next episode what's happening, that always, I feel like you get lost. So this journey was clear and we had so many conversations. Justin was always there on set. Rachel was always there. Hiro was always there. So this was the most organized project that I've been on.
Oh. And am I right that you jumped into Monarch after filming Shogun?
Yes.
How did you find that transition?
There wasn't really a transition, because I literally went home after wrapping Shogun, slept 8 hours, woke up, and went to Monarch.
Wow.
It was the next day.
I truly assumed you had at least a week in there.
I wish. Wow. But Shogun was pushing, and mm-hmm. Monarch was pushing because of that. So they were really waiting for me. So I could not say I need one day to rest. I literally, went the next day. But it was, I think, in a way helpful to kind of release Mariko. Because mm-hmm. otherwise I would have kind of just carried her for way too long. And she was a heavy character. So I needed something that would force me out of it. And it was nice to, I love the kimonos and I love the wig. And everything is just so important to the character, but it was a relief to just be able to take that off and become someone living in 2015.
That does it for this week's interview episode. We'll be back on Thursday with a roundtable discussion. You can find me on the internet at DavidCanfield97, and Hillary?
I'm at Hillabuster.
And our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs. Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.